Welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show, bringing the tales and stories of the ancient Celts to your fireside. Special episode number one, Beltane 2008. Hello and welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show. I'm Gary.
And I'm Ruth.
And it's really great you've joined us in this episode because this is a special episode that we've made to celebrate the festival of Beltane. Beltane or May Day, however you want to say it. This is a lovely time of year. If I look quickly behind me, I can see our apple tree is packed full of blossom.
That's absolutely beautiful.
It is gorgeous, isn't it? And the sun's shining. What could be better?
Absolutely super spring day.
We've got quite a few things lined up for you today. We're going to have a reading from a really old book by Lady Francesca Wilde, who was Oscar Wilde's mother, and she's written a book called Ancient Legends, Mystic Charms and Superstitions of Ireland. So that'll be fun. And further than that, we've got a special surprise in the middle of the show, which is...
Which I have to say, I don't know what that is, actually.
You do. You've just forgotten.
I may well have. Maybe I have forgotten. It's all these scripts.
One of our site members, Simon the Scribe, otherwise known as Simon Mitchell, has allowed us to read a chapter from his book.
His book? Yes. I'm sorry. The Lily? I'm sorry, Simon.
The Lily, that's book one in his Secrets of the Valley trilogy.
Yep.
And after reading this, I really want to read the book. So that's something quite exciting to look forward to. We'll end up with another reading from Lady Francesca Wilde about superstitions that are attached to May Day.
Sure. Sounds good.
Yeah. So a couple of bits of music in the middle as well. So this episode is going to be a non-standard format. Don't worry, you new listeners. Regular episodes are about 25 minutes long, not as long as this one is. So stay with us, because this is a treat, not a normal.
This episode will be about an hour long, we think, give or take.
Should be.
Trying to find a poem by Taliesin? Not sure who the Morrigan is? Need a good picture of Stonehenge? Curious about the latest archaeological finds from ancient Gaul? Hi, my name is Mary Jones. And all this and more can be found at my site, www.maryjones.us, where I run the Celtic Literature Collective, Jones's Celtic Encyclopedia, the Celtic News Update, and lots more. Again, that's www.maryjones.us. Hope I'll be seeing you.
And a big thank you to Mary Jones. I can't urge you strongly enough to go along and have a look at her site. Many of the source materials we use for our stories come from her. Well done, Mary, and thank you. So to start the show rolling, we're going to start with the reading from Ancient Legends, Mystic Charms and Superstitions of Ireland. Let's tell you a little bit about Lady Francesca Wilde herself. Lady Jane Francesca Agnes Wilde, known as Speranza, was born on the 27th of December, 1821. She was Oscar Wilde's mother. She was a renowned linguist, translator, folklorist, advocate of women's rights, popular poet, and the host of celebrated literary salons in Dublin and London. She was a celebrated figure, greatly admired and regularly cheered in the streets of Dublin. With 13 publications to her credit, she was more prolific than Oscar was. But Speranza died in relative obscurity in 1896 and was buried in an unmarked grave in Kensal Green, London. Oscar may have been surprised or inspired by such enthusiasm, but it's no overstatement. Long before he dazzled audiences and critics with his own writing, the patriotic poetry of his mother, Lady Wilde, had made her a hero of Irish nationalists across the world. Until his most famous works made him a household name in his own right, Oscar Wilde, as New York newspaper The Irish Nation pointed out, was Speranza's son. In 1996, a commemorative plaque was added to the Wilde family vault at Mount Jerome Cemetery in Dublin. She was a well-read, generous and broad-minded woman. Oscar was devoted to her. "All women become like mothers," he wrote. "That's their tragedy. No man does. That's his." So, the piece we're going to read is called The May Festival, From Ancient Legends, Mystic Charms and Superstitions of Ireland, which was published in 1887.
There were four great fire festivals held in Ireland from the most ancient pagan times. And these four sacred seasons were February, May, Midsummer and November. May was the most memorable and auspicious of all. Then the Druids lit the Beltane, the holy goodly fire of Baal, the sun god, and they drove the cattle on a path made between two fires and singed them with flame of lighted torch, and sometimes they cut them to spill blood and then burnt the blood as a sacred offering to the sun god. The great feast of Bel, or the sun, took place on May Eve, and that of Samhain, or the moon, on November Eve, when libations were poured out to appease the evil spirits and also the spirits of the dead, who came out of their graves on that night to visit their ancient homes. The Phoenicians, it is known, adored the supreme being under the name of Bel Samhain, and it is remarkable that the peasants in Ireland, wishing you good luck, say in Irish, "The blessing of Bel and the blessing of Samhain be with you," that is, of the sun and the moon. These were the great festivals of the Druids, when all the domestic fires were extinguished in order to be relit by the sacred fire taken from the temples. For it was deemed sacrilege to have any fires kindled except from the holy altar flame. St. Patrick, however, determined to break down the power of the Druids, and therefore, in defiance of their laws, he had a great fire lit on May Eve. When he celebrated the Paschal Mysteries, henceforth Easter, or the Feast of the Resurrection, took the place of the Baal Festival. Baal fires were originally used for human sacrifices and burnt offerings of the first fruits of the cattle. But after Christianity was established, the children and the cattle were passed between two fires for purification from sin, and as a safeguard against the power of the devil. The Persians also extinguished the domestic fires on the Baal festival, the 21st of April, and were obliged to relight them from the temple fires, for which priests were paid a fee in silver money. A fire kindled by rubbing two pieces of wood together was also considered lucky by the Persians. Then the water was boiled over the flame and afterwards sprinkled on the people and the cattle. The ancient Irish ritual resembles the Persian in every particular, and the Druids, no doubt, held the traditional worship exactly as brought from the East, the land of the sun and tree worship and well worship. May Day, called in Irish Lá Beltane, the day of the bale fires, was the festival of greatest rejoicing in Ireland, but the fairies have great power at that season, and children and cattle and milk and butter must be well guarded from their influence. A spent coal must be put under the churn and another under the cradle, and primroses must be scattered before the door, for the fairies cannot pass the flowers. Children that die in April are supposed to be carried off by the fairies, who are then always on watch to abduct whatever is young and beautiful for their fairy homes. Sometimes, on the 1st of May, a sacred heifer, snow-white, appeared amongst the cattle, and this was considered to bring the highest good luck to the farmer. An old Irish song that alludes to the heifer may be translated thus.
There is a cow on the mountain, a fair white cow. She goes east and she goes west, and my senses have gone for love of her. She goes with the sun and he forgets to burn, and the moon turns her face with love to her, my fair white cow of the mountain.
The fairies are in the best of humour upon May Eve, and the music of the fairy pipes may be heard all through the night while the fairy folk are dancing upon the rath. It is then they carry off the young people to join their revels, and if a girl has once danced to the fairy music, she will move ever after with such fascinating grace that it has passed into proverb to say of a good dancer,
"He's danced to fairy music on the hill."
At the great long dance held in old times on May Day, all the people held hands and danced round a great maybush erected on a mound. The circle sometimes extended for a mile, the girls wearing garlands and the young men carrying wands of green boughs, while the elder people sat round on the grass as spectators and applauded the ceremony. The tallest and strongest men in the country stood in the centre and directed the movements, while the pipers and harpers wearing green and gold sashes played the most spirited dance tunes. The oldest worship of the world was of the sun and the moon, of trees and wells, and the serpent that gave wisdom. The trees were a symbol of knowledge, and the dance round the maybush is part of the Ophite ritual. The baila also, or waltz, is associated with Baal worship, where the two circling motions are combined, the revolution of the planet on its axis, and also around the sun. In Italy, this ancient festival called the Calendi Maggio is celebrated in rural districts, much in the Irish way. Dante fell in love with the great May Day festival, held in the great Portinari Palace. The Slavonic nations likewise light sacred fires and dance round a tree hung with garlands on May Day. This reverence for the tree is one of the oldest superstitions of humanity and the most universal. And the fires are a relic of the old pagan worship paid to Apollo, fire above all things being held sacred by the Irish as a safeguard from evil spirits. It is a saying amongst them.
Fire and salt are the two most sacred things given to man. And you give them away on May Day, you give away your luck for the year.
Therefore, no one will allow milk or salt or fire to be carried away from the house on that day. And if people come in and ask for a lighted torch, they would be driven away with curses, for their purpose was evil. The witches, however, make great efforts to steal milk on the May morning. If they succeed, the luck passes from the family, and the milk and the butter for the whole year will belong to the fairies. The best preventative is to scatter primroses on the threshold, and the old women tie bunches of primroses to the cows' tails, for the evil spirits cannot touch anything guarded by these flowers if they are plucked before sunrise, not else. A piece of iron, also made red hot, is placed upon the hearth. Any old iron will do, the older the better, and branches of white thorn and mountain ash are wreathed around the doorway for luck. The mountain ash has very great and mysterious qualities. If a branch of it be woven into the roof, that house is safe from fire for a year at least. And if a branch of it is mixed with the timber of a boat, no storm will upset it, and no man in it will be drowned for a 12-month certain. To save milk from witchcraft, the people on May morning cut and peel some of the branches of the mountain ash and bind the twigs round the milk pails and the churn. No witch or fairy then will be able to steal the milk or butter. But all this must be done before sunrise. However, should the butter be missed, follow the cow to the field and gather the clay her hoof has touched. Then on returning home, place it under the churn with a live coal and a handful of salt, and your butter is safe from man or woman, fairy or fiend for that year. There are other methods also to preserve a good supply of butter in the churn. A horseshoe tied onto it, a rusty nail from a coffin driven into the side, a cross made of the leaves of Veronica placed at the bottom of the milk pail. But the mountain ash is the best of all safeguards against witchcraft and devil's magic. Without some of these precautions, the fairies will certainly overlook the churn, and the milk and butter in consequence will fail all through the year, and the farmers suffer great loss. Herbs gathered on May Eve have a mystical and strong virtue for curing disease. And powerful potions are made then by the skillful herb women and fairy doctors, which no sickness can resist. Chiefly of the yarrow, called in Irish the herb of seven needs, or cures, from its many and great virtues. Divination is also practiced to a great extent by means of the yarrow. The girls dance around it, singing,
"Yarrow, yarrow, yarrow, I bid thee good morrow, and tell me before tomorrow who my true love will be." I thought that was good.
The herb is then placed onto the... Sorry, that just tickled me. The herb is then placed onto the... That's okay.
Is it... You're trying to think of me in a gingham dress, aren't you?
Right, let's start that again. The herb is then placed under the head at night, and in the dreams the true lover will appear. Another mode of divination for the future fate in life is by snails. The young girls go out early before the sunrise to trace the path of the snails in the clay, for always a letter is marked. and this is the initial of the true lover's name. A black snail is very unlucky to meet first thing in the morning, for his trail would read death. But a white snail brings good fortune. A white lamb on the right hand is also good, but the cuckoo is ominous of evil. Of old, the year began with the 1st of May, and an ancient Irish rhyme says,
"A white lamb on my right side, so will good come to me, but not the little false cuckoo on the first day of the year."
Prophecies were also made from the way that the wind blew on May mornings. An old man, who was drawing near to his end and liked to die, inquired from those around him,
"Where did you leave the wind last night?"
They told him it came from the north.
"Then the country is lost to the clan gale. Our enemies will triumph. Had it been from the south, we should have had the victory. But now the Sassenach will trample us to dust."
And he fell back and died. Can you please stop that? It froze me totally. Ashes are often sprinkled on the threshold on May Eve. And if the print of a foot is found in the morning turned inward, it betokens marriage. But if turned outward, death. On May Eve, the fairy music is heard all on the hills, and many beautiful tunes have been caught up in this way by the people and the native musicians. About 100 years ago, a celebrated tune called Moralina was learned by a piper as he traversed the hills one evening, and he played it perfectly, note by note, as he heard it from the fairy pipes, on which a voice spoke to him and said that he would be allowed to play the tune 3 times in his life before all the people, but never a fourth, or doom would fall upon him. However, one day he had a great contest for supremacy with another piper, and at last, to make sure of victory, he played the wonderful fairy melody. When all the people applauded and declared he'd won the prize by reason of its beauty, and that no music could equal his, so they crowned him with a garland. But at that moment he turned deadly pale, the pipes dropped from his hand, and he fell lifeless to the ground. For nothing escapes the fairies. They know all things, and their vengeance is swift and sure. It is very dangerous to sleep out in the open air in the month of May, for fairies are very powerful then, and on watch to carry off the handsome girls for fairy brides, and the young mothers as nurses for fairy babes, while the young men are selected as husbands for the beautiful fairy princesses. A young man died suddenly on May Eve, while he was lying asleep under a hayrick, and the parents and friends knew immediately he'd been carried off to the fairy palace in the great moat of Granada. So a renowned ferryman was sent for, who promised to have him back in 9 days. Meanwhile, he decided the food and drink of the best should be left daily for the young man at a certain place on the moat. This was done, and the food always disappeared, by which they knew the young man was living, and came out of the moat nightly for the provisions left for him by his people. Now on the 9th day, a great crowd assembled to see the young man brought back from Fairyland. And in the midst stood the fairy doctor performing his incantations by means of fire and a powder which he threw into the flames that caused dense grey smoke to arise. Then taking off his hat and holding a key in his hand, he called out 3 times in a loud voice,
"Come forth! Come forth! Come forth!"
On which a shrouded figure slowly rose up in the mist of smoke, and a voice was heard answering,
"Leave me in peace. I am happy with my fairy bride, and my parents need not weep for me, for I shall bring them good luck and guard them from evil evermore."
Then the figure vanished and the smoke cleared, and the parents were content, for they believed the vision, and having loaded the ferryman with presents, they sent him away home.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. The full book can be found online, and we'll have links in the show notes to where you can find it. And now for a brief musical interlude with one of our favourite artists. It's Dave the Bard with "The Hills, They Are Hollow."
Thank you. I walk upon this green land, this land that I love, I see figures of chalk carved into the hillsides above. Sir Nabus, a man so proud, and the long man opens wide the gates of his world and invites you to step inside. And the hills, they are hollow and home to the fae who dance on Midsummer's Eve. Some people don't understand when I say these are the things I believe. These are the things I believe. There is an old circle of stones that stands on the moor. Every moss-covered face tells the secrets of ancient lore. The tall standers guardian, witnesses to the right, to nature's gods of darkness and of light. And the hills, they are hollow and home to the fae who dance on Midsummer's Eve. Some people don't understand when I say these are the things I believe. These are the things I believe.
Now for a small section of a modern Celtic novel by author Simon Mitchell. Simon Mitchell, better known as Simon the Scribe, is the author of the Secrets series of books, which focuses on issues around green healthcare, how to help the environment, and discussion about ecological living. Living in Cornwall, he has a strong link to the spirit of the land, and has written a novel based in Celtic society called Secrets of the Valley, The Lily. In the book, we learn that an ancient matrix of energy lies hidden in the earth, its existence and purpose all but forgotten. One strand, named the Dragon Line, passes through Cornwall, a land steeped in history and mystery since the dawn of time. Here the line passes through the valley of the River Foey. A lone ghost, abandoned in the valley of his birth, tells how the line of energy has been usurped, unbalancing the whole planetary energy matrix. In The Lily, the first novel of an extraordinary trilogy, we share his lives as he tells his tale of 2,000 years in the Foey Valley. He sets a crucial task to mend the dragon line and restore the balance of power before time itself runs out. Simon has given us permission to bring you a chapter from the book, so we have pleasure in presenting Chapter 2, Castledore, 23 AD.
Get out of the way, you oaf,
shouted the leader of the five riders. I leapt as the ponies galloped full tilt through the entrance of Castledore and just made it clear as they thundered past. Men dismounted swiftly, and the leader strode over and grabbed my jerkin.
Take care of the ponies,
he ordered, dropping me. The men were excited and swiftly converged on the chieftain's hut. Soon the fort was buzzing with news of an expected attack coming from over the river. I climbed a ladder up to the top of the stockade and looked out over the river towards the sea. There seemed nothing wrong, only the quiet. Even the birds were quiet. The air was tense as waiting for thunder. A flock of gulls took off from the wooded hills on the opposite bank, squealing into the air.
Looks to me like they'll be crossing at low tide, growled one of the men near me.
You might as well get some rest while you can. Make sure the ponies are settled first,
said the man, looking at me with knife eyes. I went back to the ponies to give them fresh straw, grain, and water. The clatter of men preparing weapons seemed isolated, easily absorbed into the eerie silence around the fort. I sat on sacks in my packed cubbyhole come storeroom, but I couldn't settle. Didn't feel sleepy. My thoughts reached back to the only time I had seen the blue-eyed man. He jumped from the boat upriver. Catching the rope, his clothes brushed against the rigging, and something fell from his belt as I sat watching. It floated to me, and I skimmed it from the water. It was a flower, travel-weary and faded, now wet, but unlike any I'd ever seen in the valley of my home. A one-sided raised seam of tiny bells hung on the brittle stalk. I put it inside my jerkin and watched the men as they disembarked at river's end. Travellers wore thick hides, considering summer warmth, but their hands and faces showed a golden brown, like my own dark-stained arms. The party shifted, carrying sacks from the boat, while the first man watched. He had a graceful quality that separated him from the others, and he stood by while they unloaded. It was as if he attracted the sunlight to himself. He turned around and looked at me. His eyes were the clear blue of intense sky, and they reached deep into me. His gaze filled me with a sense of icy calm and wonder. Warmth flooded my body as the man smiled. Should I give him back the flower? His thought reached across to me and he gently shook his head. He broke eye contact and joined his party, already entering the woods to the inland path. A single tribesman remained in the boat. He pushed off, and the rhythmical splash of oars filled the river glade, and then faded. I was alone with the sound of wind in trees, water on stone, and a strange gift, a flower.
Somebody rattled the door to my storeroom, breaking me from my thoughts. It was gloomy in here. The little light that came from under the eaves was dimmed by the bundles of hanging herb that gave the place such a distinctive smell. Sometimes made me sneeze. I'd been upriver on an errand for my stepfather when the blue-eyed man gave me the flower. I was delivering goatskins to a trader at River's End, the fort overlooking the upper tidal reach of the river. I always stopped here if I could to watch the boats and the people come and go. It was a busy route. From here it was a short walk over land to the North Coast River. Many travellers used the route as a shortcut, avoiding the pirates and the treacherous waters further to the west of land. Gold came from the north along this route. Moorland tin and hides shipped from here to trading posts by the sea, controlled by the chieftain at the fort where I now lived. Strawberry was my favourite roan, and she always snickered quietly as I stroked her whiskered face. Dobby, the other pony, was tricky. He would pretend to be tame and then throw you off when you least expected. He also nipped as soon as you turned your head. I attached his reins to Strawberry's tail and took the gradual slope, following the soft noises of the river down to the floodplain. My stepfather was impatient and violent if I didn't return quickly to work at the tannery. On the way home, I thought of the all-knowing eyes and the warmth of the man's smile. I could feel the faded flower inside my jerkin, like it was a new part of me. I knew this was a special gift. I vowed to keep it a secret, which so far I had, even though this gift had since changed my life. Shouts of men-at-arms came from outside of the storeroom where I lay. I opened my eyes. It was armed men running by. The creepy silence grew again as noon passed and the tide fell away. It made me sleepy. My thoughts turned back to home, a short way up the valley. The trees thinned from the river path, and I heard in my mind the enthusiastic greeting of the settlement dogs. The sounds and smells of home crossing the glade. I emerged from the trees and three of the dogs bounded towards me, wagging tails and showing their gums in curious dog smiles. As many huts as I have fingers stood in a grassy glade, nestling in the sunrise side of the valley woods. Smoke and the smell of a fresh-cooked stew wafted to me over the more pungent smell of hides. My stomach answered with a hungry gurgle, urged Strawberry forward.
Where have you been?
It was my stepfather, stepping from behind a large skin drying on a frame.
I've been up to River's End, Lake Gloucester. I delivered the skins to the man you told me to. He said he would see you later on.
I knew it was futile. He was always looking for fault. As I came within reach, he pulled me from Strawberry, holding me bruising hard by the upper arm. He was a big man, and I knew if I put up a struggle, he would just slap me across the back of my head.
Get on with it,
he said, pointing at a pile of skins.
This is what you should be doing.
He shoved me towards them, picked the tool from a log and threw it down at my feet. Leading Strawberry and the other roan, he stomped off muttering about idle children. He was always like this, in a perpetual black mood that sometimes worsened when he drank the rough cider brewed by his cousin. His teeth were bad, and he seemed to take it out on me for some reason. I'd never known my own father. Ma told me he was a brave and happy man, killed in a raid on the river before my first memory. She'd given me a few things that he left, which I hid when harm moved in. I took the delicate flower from my clothes and laid it safe in the sun to finish drying. I hated being a tanner's boy. As I reached into the pit of horse piss, bark and roots to pull out the next goatskin, I gagged and the stench made my eyes water. I let it drain for a moment and carried it over to the stretching racks. Globules of fat and blood still spotted the inner surface. Harm removed most of the mess before soaking, and it lay stinking in a vat nearby, ready for boiling down to oil the skins. Another vat contained rotting fish, which was reduced with quicklime into the stench mix. I put the skin on a log to drip and untied the dried one from a wooden frame. It was attached with fine plaited sinews of leather woven by my mother. I put the skin in the lean-to on top of the other dried ones and took the frame over to the fresh skin. First one corner, then opposite, then the other corner and its opposite. I attached the middle portions, tensioning the skin on opposite sides. As the sun dried, it would tighten and aid the cleaning process. The vile mess ran down my arm, soaking into my clothes and adding to my tanner's stain. Sometimes harm made me collect this runoff from the corral, a filthy pond of pony stench. I would love just one set of clothes without this taint. I could never get used to it, although it hung perpetually around our home. I attached the frame to the upright stakes and started scraping. The bright eyes of the man came to my mind. They had shown huge, open spaces, like winter sky from the top of Hillman Tor. Yet the blue was also a depth of the summer sea. For some reason, just the thought of those bright eyes lightened my load. The flower was a special gift. Just thinking about it made me smile. I looked at it drying on a log in the sun. I put down the tool and picked up the stem. The petals made a delicate noise as I stroked the flower across the skin of my cheek. It was dry. I picked up a sharper blade from the log. Running over to the pile of cured skins, I selected a goat leg that stuck out. Arm didn't miss the odd piece. I cut it off and scored down the center, making a wallet for the flower. As I folded it around the frail stem, it made a crisp sound. I replaced the flower, encased in its protective layer inside my jerkin, and went back to work. As I pulled the blade down the skin to scrape the muck, I half-closed my eyes and pictured the bell flowers nestling inside my top. The picture came clearly to my mind, but the bells hung, new and white, shining in the light of another land. And suddenly a shock of warm glow erupted in my chest next to the flower. It was like my heart had just smiled at me. I dropped the scraper in surprise and opened my eyes. Bright feeling faded from my chest. I shut my eyes again, pictured the flowers. And this time the energy grew fast, and a quicksilver thrill expanded into my upper torso, shooting down my arms and legs like white fire. I felt I was glowing, my body filling with the bright moment that sun erupts from cloud after heavy rain.
Quinton!
Boomed a voice behind me. It was Harm.
Stop your daydreaming and get inside. Your mother's made stew for your lunch. As soon as you've finished, get on with these hides. I need some for trading.
Okay.
I managed, swiftly coming back to myself. I would experiment later with this newfound gift. After work, as it was low tide, I walked across the river. Stepping stones made this an easy task. On the other bank, a little way down in the woods, was a mossy niche that caught the evening sun. There, I could be in private. I snuggled down into one of my favourite places and opened the wallet to examine the tiny flowers. The withered stem was worse for wear. The dried bells were tatty and now crushed inside the wallet. I replaced it carefully in my jerkin. Shutting my eyes, I brought the picture to my mind. I imagined the petals pure white, gleaming in their summer sun. Soon, the strange energy suffused my body. I was made of light, a filigree web of pure fire. I became motionless, suddenly petrified, a young deer caught in a moment of fright or flight. I was aware in a new way of the space around my body. My senses merged with the life under my hands. I felt the soft moss, a cushion from the mass of glittering granite below me. I could feel the flow of the river endlessly skating by at my feet. The warmth of the evening sun on my cheek was the warmth of sun on rough bark. My arms were branches, my hands the delicate twists of latticed twigs. My leaves turned gratefully to the light, whispered me their secrets. My senses extended and rooted into earth. I felt the woodlouse in the rock crevice, tasting the air for a scent of rotten wood with my fingers. I was for a moment a water vole alerted by a scrabbling noise in the ground above. A badger, shifting dirt in preparation for her short-sighted night venture. The sleepy owl starting to wake for the night's hunt. rustling and preening silent wings for deadly flight. A nearby hoot brought me out with a start. It wasn't my dreaming, but the sound of voices from outside my storeroom. I got up and left the dim room to see what was happening. The cook had broken out a round of food, bringing a cheer from the men. No ponies had been seen over the river, so Chieftain Lou sent out a handful of scouts, heavily armed on the swiftest ponies. I went back up the ladder to view the valley. The afternoon hung heavy with expectations. Screams came from the woods below, then silence. What seemed like an eternity later, four of the men rode back, one of them injured and bleeding from the shoulder. They'd been riding down the hill on this side of the river when a small party of men had ambushed them. The missing man had been dragged off his pony and clubbed about the head. The injured man had just taken a glancing blow from the tip of a sword. Lou called me over to attend the man. He sat on the ground and I placed my hand on his shoulder just above the wound. I shut my eyes and summoned the energy. Nothing happened. I opened them again. A small group of people had formed around us to watch the miracle. I tried again, but only a tiny glimmer came in return. A memory from far away. I wished I hadn't hidden the flower in my tree for safety. Quich and Con were watching.
"Told you he was a faker," said Con, loud enough for everyone to hear.
"Fintan's a faker," chimed in Quich. "Spirits deserted you, have they, Fintan?"
"I can't do it,"
I said to Lou.
"It isn't working."
"Take him to the herbalist,"
said Lou, indicating the man.
"Get him some more traditional treatment from Nibley. Lost your powers, have you, Fintan?"
he said, turning to me. I nodded sheepishly.
"That's a shame, as I think we're just about to need them."
A lookout man from the north of the stockade yelled that there were people coming. Lou ran to the platform. I followed him up the ladder. Another cry came from the other side of the fort, as a messenger arrived from the river harbour. He was hoisted up the seaward side of the fort with a rope. There were men from River's End on ponies, and others from my settlement walking up the spine of the hill. They were carrying a rough stretcher alongside which ran my sister Gerslin and my friend Carl. We ordered them into the compound, and we came back down to ground level. My mother had been injured in an attack upriver. An arrow stuck out from her side. She lay on the makeshift stretcher. I cradled her head in my hand while a tribesman called Cambria told us what happened. I looked at my mother's white face in disbelief. She was slipping away, gripping at her stomach in pain. The arrow still protruding from between her hands. I didn't have the power to make her better. I had to get out of the camp and take my gift from the tree. I ran to Lou's hut and ran in, too fast for the guard to stop me.
"Lou, Chieftain Lou, please let me leave the camp."
"A moment, boy,"
said Lou, holding up his hand for silence.
"I need this man's report from the coast first. How many boats did you say?"
The messenger from the coast closed and opened his hands four times. Lou sat down for a moment on a nearby bench.
"You hear that, Fintan? Boats full of armed men pulled up in Atlantic Bay yesterday. They spent the night working their way inland to take the whole river at once. They know what's here. That's why they're attacking."
"What is here, Chieftain Lou?"
He stood up and crossed over to a wooden chest against the wall. He opened it and called me over. Inside was the dull gleam of many tiny pieces of gold and layers of small sacks, no doubt full of the precious metal.
"Chieftain Lou, I have to leave the camp. My mother is hurt and I need to get something to help her,"
I pleaded.
"Hi, boy,"
he said.
"We're just about to be attacked. What on earth possesses you to go gallivanting about in the woods at a moment like this?"
"I just need my gift to heal my mother,"
I said desperately.
"I need the flower,"
I blurted it out. The life of my mother hung in the balance as the chieftain thought for a moment.
"So you do have something. I wonder what it was. A flower, you say? Where did you get it?"
he asked.
"A man with blue eyes gave it to me down by River's End."
I had the story finished in a trice.
"Let me go, Chieftain. My mother has no one else,"
I pleaded.
"You know how dangerous it is out there at the moment. Pirates are trying to gain control of the river system."
He paused in thought.
"On the other hand, we need your healing skills here. I cannot spare a single man to guard you. If you go, you're on your own. We need all of the ponies here, so you'll have to go on foot."
"I have to go, Chieftain. My mother is injured, and I can help her, and others only if I have the flower."
"Okay, then. Go.
Remember that there are armed men in the woods, so keep out of sight." Take this knife in case you need to defend yourself.
He handed me one of the knives from his tunic. I felt honored by the chieftain's blade. It weighed heavy as I put it into my carry sack. I ran back to my mother.
I can help you, mother.
I breathed into her ear.
Just hang on, I'll be back as soon as I can.
I kissed her hair fondly. She was very pale, but she managed a weak smile. I clutched Gerselin to me for a moment and ran for the stockade wall.
You can find out more about Simon the Scribe at simonthescribe.co.uk. More details about Simon and his work, particularly the fascinating Cornish novel, The Lily, Volume 1 in the Secrets of the Valley trilogy, can be found in our show notes for this special episode.
That was really good. I can't wait to read the book now. Another musical interlude. I was thinking that the amount of times I've heard the theme music to our show, but I haven't heard the whole of it very many times. And I was thinking maybe you guys are feeling the same way. So what do you think about playing Haghole, which is our introductory music?
Excellent.
Yeah?
Yeah, great piece of music.
It is. Coolan's Hounds with Haghole. Thank you.
great, isn't it? And now our last reading is again by Lady Wilde, and it's from Ancient Legends, Mystic Charms and the Superstitions of Ireland. And this section is called Mayday Superstitions.
The marsh marigold is considered of great use in divination and is called the shrub of Beltane. Garlands are made of it for the cattle and doorposts to keep off the fairy power. Milk also is poured on the threshold, though none would be given away, nor fire nor salt, these three things being sacred. There are many superstitions concerning Maytime. It's not safe to go on the water first Monday in May. Hares found on May morning are supposed to be witches and should be stoned. If the fire goes out on May morning, it's considered very unlucky, and it cannot be rekindled except by a lighted sod brought from the priest's house, and the ashes of this blessed turf are afterwards sprinkled on the floor and the threshold of the house. Neither fire, nor water, nor milk, nor salt should be given away for love nor money. And if the wayfarer is given a cup of milk, he must drink it in the house, and salt must be mixed with it. Salt and water as a drink is at all times considered a potent charm against evil, if properly prepared by a fairy doctor and the magic words said over it. One day in May, a girl lay down to rest at noontide on a fairy rath, a thing of great danger, for the fairies are strong in power during the May month, and are particularly on the watch for a mortal bride to carry away to the fairy mansions, for they love the sight of human beauty. So they spirited away the young sleeping girl, and only left a shadowy resemblance of her lying on the rath. Evening came on, and as the young girl had not returned, her mother sent out messengers in all directions to look for her. At last she was found on the fairy rath, lying quite unconscious, like one dead. They carried her home and laid her on her bed, but she neither spoke nor moved. So 3 days passed over. Then they thought it right to send for the fairy doctor. At once he said that she was fairy-struck, and he gave them a salve made from herbs to anoint her hands and her brow every morning at sunrise and every night when the moon rose, and salt was sprinkled on the threshold and round her bed where she lay sleeping. This was done for 6 days and 6 nights, and then the girl rose up suddenly and asked for food. They gave her to eat, but asked no questions, only watched her that she should not quit the house. And then she fixed her eyes on them steadily and said, "Why did you bring me back? I was so happy. I was in a beautiful palace where lovely ladies and young princes were dancing to the sweetest music, and they made me dance with them, and threw a mantle over me of rich gold, and now it's all gone, and you have brought me back, and I shall never, never see the beautiful palace more." Then the mother wept and said, "Oh, child, stay with me, for I have no other daughter, and if the fairies take you from me, I shall die." When the girl heard this, she fell on her mother's neck and kissed her, and promised she would never again go to the fairy rath while she lived. For the fairy doctor told her that if ever she lay down there again and slept, she would never return alive to her home any more.
Excellent, thank you. There we are. Lady Francesca Wilde, Speranza to our friends. Thank you for staying with us for our Bell Dinner celebrations. I hope you've enjoyed the show.
The next episode will be available at the expected time as normal. That's just about it from us, except to say that we hope your celebrations are fun and bring in a wonderful summer for you. Goodbye for now.
Goodbye.
Swiftly advance the host clashing on Moira. Now I've got the giggles. This is not good. Swiftly advance. Swiftly advance the hoist. The hoist.
These surgical hoists are passing on.
There is gold here, King.
Let the body of Criddenbell be cut open.
There is gold here, King. He has spoken true.
It's true.
It's true.
Bloody Nora.
You were a bit previous.
I was. What was going on there, Mum?
Before we go much further, I'd just like to remind you that at the end of the show, you can find out how to get hold of us. You, no, what I mean is how to contact us.
Okay, that wasn't a good start, was it? Never mind.
You've been listening to the Celtic Myth Pod Show, available from CelticMythPodShow.com. We hope you've enjoyed the show and will stay tuned for the next episode. You can send us a quick email or voice feedback by emailing either Gary, that's G-A-R-Y, or Ruth, R-U-T-H, at CelticMythPodShow.com. You can chat to us in the forums on our website. The show notes for this episode can also be found on the website. We'd like to say a special thank you to Coulan's Hound, who provided us with the theme music for our show. We heard Haghole at the beginning and are listening to The Skylark now. You can find out more about this foot-stomping band at www.sfhounds.com. And thanks again to Diane Arkinstone and Kim Robertson, whose music has been used for some of the incidental music in this podcast. You'll find links to their websites in our show notes.